get down on your knees.
And I went to you to just trade out for
I got more.
Excellent.
When did you graduate? Yes.
Sorry. I'll kill those trees.
Let me explain. This is a very preliminary fiscal note. This is from two grants in safety and
demand. Rather save those lives.
Range of programs in safety.
Explain that. Okay, and then
still needs it. I was given to understand that.
Thank you.
Got the delete all amendments and. They're in the. I'm pretty sure they're in the folders. Yeah, in the packets. Otherwise, take mine if you want.
I think you'll find Terry here.
So it's A1 on top.
Okay, I'll do that.
And this, there's a summary that.
Hmm?
I don't have those numbers, no. So I'm sure someone will be presenting them either for AAA or...
It's obvious today.
A summary to the
house.
How's your committee going?
I haven't had a meeting yet.
That's what the past
one was. Everything. If I'm walking across, I'm sure we'll have our meetings.
That's a good question.
This is Senator
Daisy. Yeah, I mean, I'm willing to
always.
They're just good. I went and talked.
Oh, you might have been harder to.
Because you didn't work with
you. I know
something. Viscerally, like,
what I did this morning.
The Committee on Transportation will come to order. I just want to welcome everybody back. I see a lot of the same faces out here in the crowd as previous years, but we've got a whole plethora of new people on the committee today. And as soon as the, just so everybody in the audience knows, whenever the House is done doing their circus thing that they normally do, they're going to lob us a bill back over, and we're all going to have to go up and vote on it. So there might be a little break in the action here, just so you know. The Majority Leader's office is going to let us know. We'll run up, and we'll make it quite a bit quicker than what the House is doing up there, and then we'll be back down, and we'll finish off the bill. With that said, what I intended on doing was going around the table here. There's a lot of new people. We've got staff that is, it's the same staff as last year, but a lot of people don't know them. So we'll start off with some introductions. I'm Steve Murphy. I am down in Red Wing, and I had the fortunate opportunity to be the chair of this committee and work with some really talented folks. And I'm going to start to my right, and we'll go down the table, and then we'll come back and we'll start with Billy and go this way, and I'll let Ms. Berezovsky introduce herself.
Thank you. I'm Bonnie Berezovsky, and I am Senate counsel. I'm a nonpartisan employee, and I am assigned to the Transportation Committee.
And I'm Krista Boyd. I'm also from the nonpartisan office of counsel and research for the Senate, and I'm fiscal analyst for the committee.
And I'm Jim Carlson. I'm Senator from Senate District 38, which represents Burnsville and Eagan.
Rod Skoy, State Senator from District 2 in North Central Minnesota.
And I'm Scott Dibble. I'm State Senator, District 60, which is southwest in downtown Minneapolis, and I chair the Transit Subdivision of this committee.
Michelle Fishbach, I'm the State Senator from District 14, which is just west of St. Cloud.
Katie Sieben from District 57. The largest cities are Cottage Grove and Hastings.
And I'm Amy Koch, and I represent District 19, which is most of Wright County, just west of the metro.
And I'm John Dahl, District 40, Burnsville and Bloomington.
I'm Joel Gimsey in Senate District 13, Candiolai County, Pope County, and the western third of Stearns County.
I'm Billy Ball, and I'm Committee Administrator for the Transportation Committee, and I work for Senator
I'm Bo Burnson. I'm the legislative assistant to Senator Murphy.
I'm State Senator Keith Langseth from northwestern Minnesota. This is my 27th year on this committee.
And he's here to make sure that I don't mess up. It's a big job.
Mike Jungbauer, Senate District 48, north end of the metro, cities of East Bethel, Bethel, Oak Grove, Burns Township, Elk River, Ramsey, and Anoka.
And the Republican lead for the committee.
Me, Moi, represent Senate District 67, which is the east side of St. Paul.
Dick Day, Senate District 26.
I'm Terry Bonoff, Senate District 43, which is the northern part of Minnetonka, Plymouth, and Medicine Lake.
Good afternoon. I'm Julianne Ortman. I'm the state senator from Carver County, with all of Carver County and part of Scott County in my district.
Dan Larson from District 63, which is Bloomington, Richfield, and southwest Minneapolis.
And I'm Kathy Saltzman from Senate District 56. I have 11 communities in the East Metro area, including Woodbury, Lake Elmo, parts of Stillwater, Oak Park Heights, etc.
I'm Rick Olsen. I'm Senator from District 17, which is Chisago County, most of Isanti County, and St. Francis in Anoka County.
Great. And we're also joined with Senator Leo Foley today, and Senator Foley has been not only is he a retired law enforcement officer with the State Patrol, but he's also been a leader in automobile safety, highway safety, I should say, in the Minnesota Senate, and has in the past carried the primary seatbelt bill. So, Senator Foley, we're going to find you a chair here so you can get part of the committee. Just pull one up there by Senator Olsen if you want. That's fine. Thank you. members, a couple things. One, you'll find out, and this is just to the newer members, that it's pretty difficult to juggle your schedule so that you can have so that you can be at the committee 100% of the time. It's almost impossible. What we would ask is that if you're leaving and you know that we're going to be casting votes, let Ms. Ball or Mr. Burnson know where you're going to be, and if you have a cell phone number or another way that we can contact you, leave that with them, and we'll, if we're going to have a vote, we'll call you, get you back down here. Also make sure that they know that you want to vote. Sometimes people don't want to, and that's fine too. But if you have intentions on voting on a bill, please let the staff know, and we'll get you back down here, and we'll hold committee time so that you can get down here and vote. And with that, we're also joined with Senator Olsen. We went around and we introduced everybody, so go ahead.
I'm Jen Olsen.
Well,
Senator from District 33, and glad, looking forward to being back on transportation. I did serve 1 4-year stint on transportation before, and looking forward to the unique challenges that this field of endeavor offers.
Well, welcome aboard. We're happy to have you. a couple other notes, or at least one. We do have the subcommittee that Senator Dibble is chairing, the subcommittee on transit. They're going to be doing a lot of work putting together a transit component for a funding and policy package. And we are looking to our Republican colleagues to help us with the membership on not only the transit subcommittee, but then we have another working committee that Senator Rest is going to chair that deals with planes, trains, and barges. And we have people assigned to it, but we don't have everybody's name in the hat yet. And we need one more Republican to step up to the plate to be on one of these committees. So Senator Jungbauer is in charge of that, and he's talked with folks. So let's make it happen here in the next week or so that we can move along. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to also say that, of course, while we have to confine the membership of the committee, there's clearly tremendous interest in the transit subcommittee. So I'll let everyone know when we have those meetings. Everyone is, of course, welcome to attend, and just let us know if you're going to be there. We'll make sure your nameplate is there, and you can fully participate in any conversation discussions that we have.
Excellent. Thank
just
you.
Just can't vote.
Thank you. I don't think there's anything else we need to do. No. I think that was the only business that we needed to take care of at this time. members, we're going to present the primary seatbelt bill today, and our vice chair, Senator Carlson, is going to run the committee. This is a difficult issue for a lot of people, so please bear with us because I think there's probably going to be a few wet eyes before the day is over. And I just want to say that a person that that I admire in the area of traffic safety, Catherine Swanson, is here with us today, and she's going to start off after I kind of explain the bill a little bit and then give you a lot of background. And Catherine has worked for more years than I can imagine, and she's only a young woman, so it's a long time on this issue, and it's time for it to become a reality. For every percentage point that we can increase our seatbelt compliance means that we're going to save another 10 lives. And if we can get our seatbelt compliance rate up into the 90s, that means in the state of Minnesota that we're going to save approximately 40 to 50 lives every year. And this is why people like Ms. Swanson and Senator Foley have been hammering away at this for more years than we can imagine. With that, I'll let Mr. We're going to go back in at 2:45, they say, session, so we'll be done by then. And with that, we'll let Senator Carlson take over here.
Thank you very much. We'll hear from Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, Senate File 16, we have a delete all amendment in front of us. And members, this is a procedural motion. The delete everything amendment is the A1 amendment, and I would move adoption of the A1 amendment.
All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? The ayes have, the motion is carried.
Thank you. Thank you, committee members. Committee members, you'll see there's several lines of stricken language on the first couple pages, and then there's also some provisions on the last page. I'll briefly go through this, and then we'll start taking testimony. There's Ms. Berzowski and Ms. Boyd have also prepared a summary of the bill, and I'll refer to the summary of the bill here. Section 1 changes the seatbelt law in the following ways. It will require all passengers to wear a seatbelt, front seat, back seat, everybody. It subjects the driver to a $25 fine. For each driver or for each violation of the seatbelt law by the driver and any passenger under the age 15. I'll explain that in a little bit. It also provides that the court cannot impose more than one surcharge on the driver, and it also allows primary enforcement of the seatbelt law. Currently, we do have a seatbelt law on the books, but it's a secondary offense. It's, we're one of the last states that have the seatbelt law as a secondary offense. This moves it to a primary offense, which means that law enforcement can stop you strictly for not wearing your seatbelt. When you hear the testimony, you'll understand why. And then back to the delineation between passengers who are 15 years old and older being fined. Our thinking is this. Younger drivers and younger passengers are disproportionately killed on Minnesota roads, nationally, I do believe. We want to get their attention early and often. Now, most drivers who are in that 15 to 17-year-old range have went through driver's training courses. In those driver's training courses, they stress the importance of wearing seat belts. That's the first time we get their attention. If they get pulled over and they don't have one and have to pay $25 in the associated court costs, we're going to get their attention again. The reason why we want to get their attention is to save their life, period. Don't wear a seatbelt, get in a rollover accident, chances are you're going to get ejected or you're going to get your neck broke, one of the two. We don't want that to happen. Sections 2 and 3 strike some inconsistent and redundant language in other sections of the law pertaining to the drivers with instructional permits and drivers on provisional licenses. Section 4 establishes the $20 court charge for the seatbelt violations. So those people who, what we want to do, and Senator Roebling was kind of key in this over the past few years, was bringing up the fact that this is only a $25 fine, and yet when you throw court costs in on top of it, now you're getting into the hundreds and possibly two hundreds of dollars. And for this, not very many people go to court. So why should we have a court cost if they're not going to be in court? This is an issue that's going to be resolved in Senator Moy's committee. I think that's the next stop for the bill. And we'll flesh all that out there. But the reason behind this is that we want to get people's attention, but we don't want to put families who are kind of on the bubble there, we don't want to put them in an undue financial hardship. But we also want to make sure that we get their attention. Members, that's the way the bill kind of lays. And I think we're going to have Ms. Swanson come up now.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, is it appropriate to ask questions now? Do we want to take it before we take testimony regarding the bill itself?
You can ask questions, Senator Fischbach.
Okay, yes. Thank you. Mr. Chair, Senator Murphy, just so that I understand the surcharge issue a little bit better, mm-hmm. You could have, let's say, three violations in the car. It would be 25, 25, 25, mm-hmm. plus the surcharge that the state essentially. But then there's a $20 surcharge on page 3. So that would be mm-hmm. in there too?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Fischbach, that is not in addition. That's for those individuals who are not going to pay the full load of court costs. In other words, it does take a little bit to move the paper around, and we don't want, you know, the counties are the ones that are going to be, if somebody decides to go to court, they're the ones that are going to have to prosecute the case. So there's going to be one surcharge, and the driver is more than likely going to have to pay that. The other passengers of the vehicle that were not belted, they get the $25 fine plus a $20 court cost or whatever. But like I said, Senator Moy is probably a better expert on that end of it. What we've heard in the past, once again, Senator Roebling was very adamant about this, is that we don't want these court costs driving people to the poorhouse.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Murphy, just bear with me on this one because I'm having – so let's say older children, so that I'm responsible for their money or for paying their fine. Let's say they're – I'm trying to think the 15-year-olds. Okay, so it's not like adults that are in the car with me. You would have the three violations mm-hmm. and the surcharge would only be 20? Okay. All right, that's what I was the additional ones aren't on there.
The Senator additional Murphy. Ones, correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the same subject, my question, the surcharge that you were just talking about relative to court is just one surcharge, the $20 one. But the one on page 1, line 20 and 21, is the surcharge that was added through our time of budget difficulties, was it not? And how big is that? That's a pretty hefty one, is it not?
Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to defer to Ms. Berezovsky.
Our counsel, Ms. Brzozowski, will explain the surcharge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Olson and senators, I believe the surcharge existed before the budget deficit, but it was increased in those years, and the general surcharge is now $72, although there is an exception for parking violations, which is $4. So Senator Murphy in his bill is proposing a different surcharge for seatbelt violators, and that would be $20 rather than the $72 that would otherwise apply.
Senator Olson.
So, Mr. Chair, that's what I wasn't clear about. It says that the court may not impose more than one surcharge under the Section 357, so that would be the $72. It would seem to me that the $72 would be probably applied to the driver, but not to the additional passengers, and the $20 would be in addition to that. Are you saying it's going to be one or the other, only the $20 and not the $72 at all? Otherwise, I would have thought you would have said that the court may not oppose a surcharge under 357.02.01 if you were only intending there to be a $20 surcharge.
Right.
Senator Murphy?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, on page 1, line 20, it says the court may not impose more than one surcharge on the driver. So the driver's going to get that, the bare minimum is like $72 court costs. Okay, that's the surcharge. We didn't want to pile them all on them, otherwise we wouldn't be able to afford it. The $20, Ms. Brzozowski.
Ms. Brzozowski.
Mr. Chair, in this bill, amends the surcharge section of law on page 3. So it adds a $20 surcharge that didn't, instead of the $72 surcharge, and it applies only to seatbelt violations.
So that it's
Ms. Olson.
So, Mr. Chair, and
Brzozowski.
Yeah.
So the 357.021 is somehow negated by, you said, because for a violation of under 169.686, which is seatbelt, there's a $20 surcharge. But I'm not finding the language. Yes, I do see it now. In line 1 and 2, there's the $72. That's the one that is actually referred to in 357.021. Not having that language in front of me, that's what I'm having trouble with. I thought there was an additional charge, but there is not. There is no $72. There's only a $20.
Mr. Chair and Senator, the language is before you, actually, on page 3. That is the section of law that imposes the surcharge.
Okay.
And the way it would read if this bill is enacted is that there's a $72 surcharge on all violators, except for there's a $4 surcharge for parking violators and there's a $20 surcharge for seatbelt violators, and those are alternative. So a seatbelt violator would pay a fine plus a $20 surcharge, no $72 surcharge.
Senator Olson.
So, Mr. Chair, the $20 surcharge would apply to any of the passengers as well as the driver?
One time.
Or just the driver, and the passengers would not have, based on the language on one, that the court may not impose more than one surcharge. Does that mean the passengers then would only have the $25 fine, but the driver would have the additional surcharge?
Ms. Brzozowski.
Mr. Chair and Senator, the more than one surcharge is, that limitation applies to the driver because the driver would be responsible for violators under the age of 15. Any passengers who are 15 or older than that would be responsible for their own fine. They would be a violator of the law, and they would have to pay the $20 surcharge.
Okay.
Senator Murphy?
Thank you, Senator Carlson. So, Senator Olson, you see that we're trying to make it, we're trying to make it less onerous when it comes to the dollar figure. So, okay, thank you. If we could, Ms. Swanson?
Please state your name for the record.
I'm Kathy Swanson. I'm the Director of the Office of Traffic Safety in the Minnesota Department of Public Safety, and I'm so glad to be here today to give you some information about seatbelt use in Minnesota and what role seatbelt non-use plays in the traffic deaths that happen every year on our roads. Most of the information that I'll be giving you today comes from our annual publication, Minnesota Motor Vehicle Crash Facts. But I have some national information that comes from a booklet that the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has recently published called Primary Enforcement Saves Lives, The Case for Upgrading Secondary Safety Belt Laws. NHTSA has a lot of information. This is a booklet that you may find useful, and I just wanted to be sure that you knew of its existence. For the past 20 years or so, Minnesota's traffic fatalities have been hovering around the 600 mark. It's bounced around a little bit, but roughly 600 people die every year just on Minnesota's highways. It's a huge number. If you think about it, it is roughly 2 funerals a day just from traffic crashes. We have had some progress in the last 3 years, and it looks like for 2006, the number of fatalities will be closer to 500. We're delighted by that, but we're also hoping that none of you think that 500 is an acceptable number. During the same time period, we have seen changes in seatbelt use in Minnesota. This graph shows you that seatbelt use went from roughly 20% before any law was passed to a point where we are now at 83% belt usage in Minnesota. The Office of Traffic Safety does an annual survey of seatbelt use. We use a statistical process to go out and determine what belt use is across the state. We do that every August, and this graph shows you the results of those surveys. When you look at this graph, you might have the notion that we're making steady progress and that there's nothing else that really needs to be done. I want to tell you that I don't think that's quite how you should read the graph. I see actually 3 phases of seatbelt use in this graph. The first phase comes back when the secondary law that we have was initially passed. The law was passed in 1986. A $10 fine was added in 1988, and the fine was increased to $25 in 1991. That's the last time anything has been done legislatively to Minnesota's seatbelt law. And you see that during that time phase, we saw increases in belt use. Belt use responded to the fact that a law was passed in the first place, responded again to the fact that there was a fine set on that law, and responded again when the fine was increased. The second phase is the phase in which we had the basic law, plus we did some additional enforcement of that law. Through the Office of Traffic Safety and through funds that are provided by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, we have been able to conduct our Safe and Sober campaign throughout these years. And a part of that campaign has been concentrated efforts to enforce the secondary law that is available. During that time, you see again that belt use increased around 1996. We sort of redoubled those efforts, trying to get a little more strategic in our implementation of the enforcement, and saw another increase around the year 2000. The third phase is the phase that we're in right now. We have the law, we have the basic enforcement that we've been able to do, and both nationally and on a state level, we have had some funding that allows us to have some paid advertising that alerts the public to the enforcement efforts that are going on. And you can see here again that 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 extra little piece, the paid advertising, gave us another little bump in seatbelt use. So those are the three phases, basically, that we've had so far. And if you look at this, you might think we've done everything we can, we've made good progress, and we ought to be satisfied. I have a tendency not to be satisfied when there are 500 or 600 people dying every year on our roads. And let me tell you why. We have this gap between the 83% usage that we have right now and the 100% usage, which would be ideal. That gap represents those people who are hardest to persuade about the value of wearing seatbelts. That gap represents the people who are also most likely to die in crashes on our highways. These are the people for whom basic information about physics isn't enough to get them to buckle up. People for whom basic information about a secondary law has not been enough. A fine hasn't been enough. The public information and education and enforcement that we've done hasn't been enough. It's that last 20% that is hardest to reach. There is a gap between what happens, what we observe every August in our seatbelt survey, and what we see in fatal crashes in Minnesota. This graph shows you the difference. The blue line is observed usage in Minnesota. The red line below it is what we see in belt usage among people who are killed in crashes on our roads. Belt usage among those people killed in crashes is much lower than belt usage in general. The people who find themselves in fatal crashes are different from the average population in terms of their belt use. They wear it less frequently. And so anything we can do to convert that last 20% will increase belt usage and we'll have fewer people showing up in our fatal crashes on the highways. So again, what we're looking at is this gap and finding ways that we can address that gap, finding ways that we can close it, finding ways we can get that last 20% to wear their seatbelts. Let me tell you a little bit about who falls into that gap. Who's dying on our highways? They tend to be young people. They tend to be male. They tend to be in the rural areas. Drinking and driving and impairment is a big issue, and speeding is a big issue. And I've got some information on each of those that I want to share with you. Young people are overrepresented in fatal crashes. 25%, one quarter of the fatalities, are people between the ages of 15 and 24. 61% of the fatalities are people under the age of 45. By anyone's definition, either group, far too young to die, and yet very much overrepresented in traffic fatalities. Men are also overrepresented in traffic fatalities. Over two-thirds of the traffic fatalities are men. Rural areas are overrepresented as well. 72% of the fatal crashes that occur happen in areas of less than 5,000 population. I was once asked in a hearing whether, if you just looked at the seven-county metro area versus the rest of the state, if that sort of urban, rural, metro, non-metro statistics still held up. It does. It's surprisingly about the same thing. So no matter how you want to define rural, 72%, nearly three-quarters of the traffic fatalities happen in rural areas. 35% of the traffic fatalities happen in vehicles where one of the drivers was under the influence or had been drinking. And 29% of the traffic fatalities happen in a vehicle where one of the vehicles was speeding. Young men in rural environments, drinking and driving, drinking and speeding, those are the kinds of situations that lead to fatal crashes. And belt use for most of those situations is different than even the population of people found in fatal crashes. Let me show you what I mean. The last 3 years, belt use among people in fatal crashes has been about 39 or 40%. That's represented by that red line there. What's graphed in blue are the people in fatal crashes in the last 3 years by age group. So now this is not the average population. These are the people who find themselves in fatal crashes. Sadly, the people whose families bury them because they were killed in a traffic crash. When you look at the young ages, the 10 to 14 all the way up to about age 45, their belt use tends to be lower than even those, the rest of those people who are in fatal crashes, way lower than the population as a whole, but under that average for the people who find themselves in fatal crashes. When you look at that, also including gender, you find that the women in the crashes tend to be a little bit better than the average for fatalities. The men tend to be even worse. Here's something that was a little bit of a surprise to me. When you look at the rural population, I actually expected that there would be a greater difference in the lines between the urban, which is the pink line, and the rural, which is the blue. What has happened over the years is what used to be a big gap in how belt use occurred in rural areas versus urban areas, that gap has closed. But because fatalities happen so much more frequently out in the rural areas, because of road design, because of speed issues, because of slower EMS response time, it is all the more important that people in rural areas wear their seatbelts. Here's one that surprised me, but people told me I just didn't know enough drinking drivers. I wouldn't have been surprised if I knew more. The more people drink, the less likely they are to have their seatbelt on. Again, these are drivers who are killed in crashes. I guess that shouldn't be surprising. They're making a poor decision to drink and drive. They're also making a poor decision about whether or not to protect themselves with a seatbelt. Here's actually the graph that surprised me the most, and it's because of what I often hear from people. This one has to do with speeding. You'll see that for people killed in crashes where speeding was started as a factor, that belt use for almost all of the age groups is well below the average for other people killed in crashes. I'm surprised by this because what I hear from friends and family is that, yeah, well, I might speed a little bit, but I always have my belt on. The people who were killed didn't. They sped, and their belt wasn't on. And they ended up in our crash facts as statistics and fatalities. Several years ago, we had a public information campaign called Buckle Up or Pay the Price. What I want to tell you now is who actually pays that price. We all do, but let me focus on families, on society, and on businesses. I've mentioned already how families pay the price. In 2006, 500 deaths. 2005, the last year that we have analyzed statistics, there were 260 unbelted deaths on our highways. 100% belt use could have prevented between 130 and 160 of those deaths. I don't know that primary seatbelt law will give us a 100% use. That's why we're estimating more like 40 lives saved from a primary seatbelt law. Society also pays the price, and these figures are from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration's booklet that I mentioned earlier. Nationally, crashes in general cost the country over $230 billion. 85% of those costs are borne by society, not by the individuals involved. By society, I mean by government-paid sources and by insurance. Your insurance rates are higher because not everybody wears their seatbelt. Medicare, Medicaid, and other taxpayer-funded sources pay about 24% of those costs. And according to national figures, when crash victims aren't buckled, their medical costs are 50% higher than they would have been otherwise. One of the things that you should know is that Minnesota has done its own analysis of the hospital charge data. And what we found is that for Minnesota, those unbuckled crash victims actually have hospital charges that are 94% higher than buckled people. You have, I believe, a codes fact sheet that gives you some information about that. Businesses also pay the cost. Again, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says that crashes on and off the job cost businesses $16.1 billion annually in lost productivity. Motor vehicle crashes added $16.3 billion to the health-related portion of employers' fringe benefit costs, some of it for health care costs and some of it for sick leave and life insurance and disability insurance benefits for crash victims. So to start summing up, let me tell you what we know. We know that seatbelt use saves lives, and it saves families, it prevents funerals, it saves dollars. We also know that strong enforcement of strong seatbelt laws increases belt use. And we have NHTSA studies and experience from other states that have gone from a secondary law to a primary law that suggests that Minnesota would see an increase of anywhere between 6 percentage points and 12 percentage points. The states that are most similar to Minnesota, and I point to Washington State here, when they increased the strength of their seatbelt law, they saw an increase of about 11 percentage points. We think that's what would happen in Minnesota. Here's what else we know, and this is the part that is perhaps hardest to get to, hardest to accept on the part of my office. Our strong enforcement efforts, which we have been funding for more than a dozen years, have reached a point of diminishing returns. Belt use decreased in 2006 from 84% in 2005 to 83%. That decrease is despite all of the efforts that we put into our safe and sober enforcement, the public information campaigns, the various efforts that have gone on both at the state level and nationally to get people to buckle up. Here's one other thing that I want you to be sure that you're aware of. The federal government has decided that states should all have an incentive to change their law from secondary to primary. The Safety Lou Transportation Bill provides financial incentive, which would amount to about $15 million in Minnesota if we were to change from a secondary to a primary law. The multi-department group that works on these things has identified three things that we'd like to invest that funding in: more cable median barriers, which prevent crossover crashes, greater speed enforcement, which we think was a significant factor in the reduction of fatalities that we saw in 2006, and aid to county and state roads for engineering improvements, especially on those areas where the higher number of fatalities are happening in the rural areas. Let me close with a quote from former Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta. He said, "We are in the midst of a national epidemic. If this many people were to die from any one disease in a single year, Americans would demand a vaccine. The irony is we already have the best vaccine available to reduce the death toll on our highways: safety belts." The Department of Public Safety and our traffic safety partners have been doing all that we can with the resources that we've been given to get belt use up as high as possible. We need everyone's help to help move Minnesota towards zero deaths. A stronger seatbelt law would be the most significant single contribution that you could make at this time. Thank you for your attention. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, ma'am, is there any information that would distinguish in the deaths in the various traffic accidents, if the person not wearing the seatbelt is the driving the vehicle that's the cause of the crash, or in the vehicle that is the victim of the crash?
Ms. Swanson.
Mr. Chair, Senators, it is difficult with the crash data that we have to firmly assign causation or victim status to the vehicles. That's one of those things that is perhaps best done in courts of law.
So the data that we have, our crash database, is not well designed for being able to make that kind of identification.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With us today also is Colonel Ann Beers, retired chief of the State Patrol. And Colonel Beers, did you want to make any comments? Or?
Well, I'd like to thank Ms. Swanson for her excellent report and a lot of her analysis here. I've sure learned a lot, and I think everyone else did too. Thank you very much.
For the record, I'm Ann Beers, retired from the Department of Public Safety, State Patrol. It wasn't my intent or purpose to be here to testify today, but I gladly accept the opportunity that the senator has provided. I've had a 30-year career in traffic enforcement and traffic safety. The partnership that Kathy Swanson talked about, Towards Zero Death Partnership, is the most integrated and sophisticated effort I've ever seen in any state, and I think we're leading the country in what we're doing. She talked about the impact on businesses and families. Towards Zero Death is a concerted effort with the engineers, the local and state engineers, businesses, educators, students, traffic safety professionals. And why is that? Because combined, we need to make a difference to be able to save lives. And singularly, this is the most cost-effective, simplest thing that we can do to save lives. As Kathy had stated, we don't know exactly what that number could be. It could be we're going to save 30 lives, 40 lives, 50 lives. If one of those is one of your love members or a member of your church or your community, would you not want to be in a position to say that you change public policy in support of this to be able to make that difference? This is an important traffic safety policy thing, and I can't think of any other single thing that could give a better tool to law enforcement to be able to get their job done and to change the death toll that's happening on our roadways in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Colonel Beers. Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, next on the list, I believe, is the Commissioner of Department of Public Safety, but he's asked to move to the bottom of the list. I also want to note that Chief Donansky, our current State Patrol Chief, would be here today, but he was ill. And knowing Chief Donansky, he must be pretty sick if he's not here today, because he's a pretty hard charger. So if we could move down the list, Mr. Chairman.
We have Sheriff John Sanner from Stearns County is next. Please state your name for the record.
My name is John Sanner. I'm the sheriff of Stearns County.
Sheriff Sanner.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, first of all, thank you very much for this opportunity to come and talk with you folks today. As the legislative liaison for the Minnesota State Sheriff's Association, I represent all 87 sheriffs in the state of Minnesota, and we very strongly endorse the passage of a primary seatbelt law in this state. And we're partnered with other major law enforcement agencies in the state, being the State Patrol and the Minnesota Police Chiefs Association. Everyone is in firm agreement that this can do nothing but good things. I was going to give you some statistical information, but Kathy has covered that very well already. But one of the issues that comes up is the fact that right now Minnesota looks at the seatbelt violation as a secondary offense. And a bit of a stigma comes with that, that it's not necessarily an important thing then. So that would describe why, when states around us and other states have gone from secondary to primary, compliance increases on an average of 10%. Because once it goes to a primary offense, people start to realize that this is something that all of us think is important. Since I can't talk to you or won't be redundant as far as the statistical information is concerned, I would like to share a few things with you on a very personal note. I probably, in fact, I know that I've delivered more death notifications than I care to remember in my career as a deputy sheriff and as a sheriff's office administrator. If we can do anything, anything at all, to reduce that number of notifications, nothing devastates a family like getting that knock in the middle of the night and letting them know that a loved one is never going to come home again. if there is some way that we can cut that number even by one, we should be doing that. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheriff Center. Any questions for Sheriff Center from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Olsen.
Sheriff, the numbers are amazingly, I think they're similar in my county, probably throughout the state, where we have a number of rural roads. And it just makes sense, you know, the rural roads, driving at night, maybe intoxicated. Is that the what you find in your county, too, primarily young males? And
absolutely. The statistical information that Kathy provided is exactly what we're seeing out on the road. No doubt about that.
Do you have a freeway through your district?
Yes, we do.
Do you find a lot of accidents along the freeway, or are they primarily on the rural roads?
I think we're finding more of our accidents on the county roadways, more of our fatal accidents, and severe bodily injury.
Thanks.
Any other questions for the witness? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Sheriff. One of the difficulties I have with the primary aspect of the seatbelt law is that I have a hard time seeing that not wearing the seatbelt causes an accident. Now, maybe you can tell me that that is the case. The death, yes, I can understand. But even in the great data that Ms. Swanson presented to us, it's the impairment, the speeding, the other kinds of behaviors that tend to cause the accidents. And, you know, we're concerned about that we may not have enough law enforcement people. It bothers me a bit that the tendency may be, or the temptation might be, for law enforcement to work on the low-hanging fruit. It's easier just to see that somebody doesn't have a seatbelt and ticket them, rather than to be even ever more vigilant and enforcing both our speeding laws and our driving under the influence. Because that's the behaviors. Those are the behaviors that are causing the accidents. It's, you know, our personal responsibility. If we're driving within the law, but choosing not to wear a seatbelt, it's a shame. I totally agree with that. It's a risk that's being taken. But the cause of it is the one that I hope it would seem to me that it's going to take time away and energy and resources to deal with that behavior rather than the behaviors that are really causing the accidents and the death. Can you?
Yeah, Senator Olson. Thank you. I don't necessarily disagree with what you're saying. And I know that one of the concerns in looking at the seatbelt law as a primary is this another tool for law enforcement to stop people, pull people over, write them tickets? And I think if you would caucus the law enforcement community in the state of Minnesota, you would get a resounding no to that. What this does more than anything is reduce the possibility of death or serious bodily injury, irregardless of why the accident happens or the crash happens in the first place. If they are wearing the seatbelts, statistically, they are probably not going to suffer the severity of injury or the possibility of death at such a great rate.
Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, committee members, those four... The four leading causes of death, Ms. Swanson went over them, and they're all personal behaviors. I mean, it's your choice whether or not that, you know, that you're driving inattentively. You're eating a donut, having a cigarette, talking to the three people in the back seat, on the phone, driving with your left knee so that you can keep your right foot above the brake because you know you're going to miss it when the guy in front of you slams on his brakes and, you know, you want to be there right away. So whether it's inattentive driving or pouring mass quantities of alcohol down your throat or choosing not to wear your seatbelt, those are all violations of current law. All we're doing is throwing another tool in the toolbox for our officers like the sheriff here so that they can pull people over, write them a ticket for not wearing their seatbelt. I mean, it's pretty simple. We're giving them another tool. If you're breaking the law, you deserve to get a ticket, period. What we've said with our current law is it's okay to break the law because we're not going to pull you over and write you a ticket unless you got a brake light out or you run up over the curb or you do something else aberrant to get the sheriff's attention. What we're saying now is if the sheriff's driving down the road and he sees the seatbelt hanging in the shoulder strap over here and not buckled up, they can pull you over, give you a gentle $25 reminder plus the surcharge. It's going to cost you $100. I think that $100 is a pretty good investment in that individual because it gets their attention. The next time they'll have the lap belt on. Senator Olson, you're right. If you're not wearing the lap belt and you're driving down the road, minding your own business, being a conscientious driver, chances are you're probably not going to get in an accident. But you know what? Everybody in this room is going to get in an accident sooner or later. All those new drivers that we're training, sooner or later you're going to get in an accident. And if you're wearing your seatbelt 100% of the time, we're not going to be able to blame your death on not obeying the law. Mr. Chairman,
Senator Murphy,
I've got somebody around here running to get a statute book, but in Chapter 169, I think it's book number 6 over there, if you look in there, there's hundreds of pages of traffic regulation. Driving an automobile or an 18-wheeler or whatever you're on the road with is the most heavily regulated daily activity that any of us are going to do. And for us to sit here and say that we're going to put laws on the books and then not let the sheriff enforce them, I think is cowardly.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, I think the practice that I've noticed more recently of their probably selectively, if they had the choice of taking over two cars that were speeding, picking the one that they're not wearing the seatbelt is perfectly legitimate. And giving them a double whammy. But I do still have a hard time with, as I say, picking the low-hanging fruit rather than going after the behavior that actually causes the accident. Just given the resources, and I don't want to make any accusations there, but there can be a temptation in the use of time, and I know we don't allow quotas in terms of tickets issued, but there's still... I can still see a temptation to do that over going after the tougher behaviors that are actually causing the most physical and property damage.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I'll let the sheriff take that.
Sheriff Sander.
You know, I don't think that the Stearns County Sheriff's Office and our patrol division is unique at all. And if you were to talk with our patrol officers, they're not interested in writing a lot of tickets. They're interested in providing public safety. And that's really what this is all about, is it not?
In the interest of time, I think we have to move along. Senator Murphy, do you have?
Thank you, Sheriff.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sheriff Sander. Next person we have on the list is Lonnie Joyce. From Alexandria. Please state your name for the record.
Lonnie Chose.
Chose. Thank you very much. Ms. Chose.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Lonnie Chose from Alexandria. Thank you for allowing us this opportunity to address you. David and I are parents of four children. Our daughter, Kelsey, was killed on November 8th, 2004. We are still parents of four. I am still her mom. Death takes away so many things, but it will never take away the fact that she was here. She was and still is ours. It was a beautiful fall day. I had driven her to school that morning because her car was in the shop. School was out at 2:30. And she caught a ride home from a girlfriend. The driver lost control of the car, and it rolled. The driver was belted, and her injury was a broken finger. Kelsey was not wearing her seatbelt and was thrown from the vehicle. She was airlifted to HCMC, but she did not survive the flight. We don't know what happened that day. Why didn't she have her seatbelt on? As a driver, she always wore it, and as a passenger with me, I know it was always on. Just that one click would have made all the difference in the world to everyone that loved her. She would have been a bridesmaid in her brother's wedding this August. She would be a freshman at the University of Minnesota, hopefully. She would be spending her first semester break at home with her younger brother and us right now. Our entire community has felt the loss of Kelsey. Her fellow classmates at Jefferson High School started a Click It for Kelsey campaign to raise awareness regarding seatbelt use. They sold green wristbands, made several presentations to area schools, and visited with legislators. I am a member of our Douglas County Safety Coalition, and we are very optimistic that our community is behind this bill. Minnesota is moving in the right direction, but just not fast enough. There are too many of our loved ones dying and being severely injured. They are both young and old, and from all walks of life. Every community has their own Kelsey story. I am sure that many of you have one of your own. It is time to stop the loss. It is time to make a difference. Kelsey's short 17 years impacted the lives of so many. I wish you all could have known her. She always had a smile on her face, and she was mature beyond her years. She envisioned herself as a film director one day. She was a loyal friend, awesome sister, and loving daughter. David and I always tell our children to make someone smile, and that is just what she did. She made it a way of life, using her humor and unique ways to put a smile on the faces of those around her. Whether she was at school, competing in sports, at work, in the community, or at home, she always had her head on straight. I would do anything to not be here today. The truth is, I should have been here 6 years ago. You see, in 2000, our oldest son was also in a car crash. He was alone and was belted. He was airlifted to HCMC, just like Kelsey. He sustained a brain injury, and I am very thankful to report that he has made a complete recovery. But why didn't I use his crash as an incentive to get this law passed back then? It is because until tragedy strikes right in your own heart, most constituents are detached from what is happening here in the political arena. I never was very political, and I just assumed that laws were being made that would protect my family and myself. I took for granted the work that you do here. I forgot that I have a voice and that the only way you know what we need is by us speaking up. Well, here I am, and I know that I speak for many. If only I had been pounding the steps of my Capitol years ago, maybe we would have Kelsey in our arms today. It has been over 2 years since Kelsey died, but it seems like yesterday. We can't change the past. But you are in the position to change the future. Imagine your loved ones on our roads without their seatbelts on. Ask yourself, would you want law enforcement to be able to stop them? Especially if you knew that that action, that ticket, would have saved their lives. We sure wish that could have happened on that fateful November afternoon in 2004. Kelsey's family and friends have been entrusted with the memories of her life. Now David and I are entrusting you with the story of her death. Please let her story, her death, and the deaths of so many others move you to pass this bill. Add Minnesota to the growing list of states that recognize seatbelt usage can no longer be a choice. It is a necessity. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Chose. Are there any questions from the committee? Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Chose, this is not a question but a comment. I joined the Transportation Committee last year in the 2005 session, and I had the privilege of hearing you then, and number one, I voted for the bill then. But you really changed things in my household. I have a son the same age, and he didn't ever wear his seatbelt, and I told that story, and I still can remember doing that. And so every time we'd get in the car, he'd look at me and he'd go, "Click it for Kelsey, Mom." And so it really made a difference in our home, and thank you for doing that.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. Senator Murphy. Next.
Mr. Chairman, we can just go right down the list.
Okay.
And
Next person on our list is Mr. Michael Sandman from Bethesda Rehabilitation. Please state your name for the record.
Hi, I'm Mike Sandman.
Mr. Sandman.
My name is Michael Sandman. I'm a physical therapist, and I work about three blocks away from here at Bethesda Hospital. I'm the director of physical medicine. I'm in charge of all of the therapies. Bethesda Hospital sees some of the most severe spinal cord and brain injury patients in the state. I'd like to primarily talk about spinal cord injury today with you because we've got people, I believe, talking from the standpoint of the cost to our state and to our people of brain injury. Spinal cord injury incidence is caused in the greatest extent by motor vehicle accidents. Minnesota has a statistic of 38% of our spinal cord injuries caused by motor vehicle accidents. Nationally, where recreational injuries aren't as significant, that is a statistic of 50% of all spinal cord injuries are caused by motor vehicle accidents. The National Spinal Cord Injury Statistical Center estimates that the lifetime cost of a high spinal cord injury, the type that we see next door, from C1 to C4, is about $2.25 million, and that's only for the medical cost. It doesn't include the cost to the family, the cost to lost opportunities for the patient through his or her life. I'd say his or her, most of our spinal cord injuries are men, and most of them are young men. The national trends for injuries not wearing seatbelts versus injuries wearing seatbelts are interesting in a couple of factors. Studies have shown that people who are in a crash and have a spinal cord injury have a less severe injury if they were wearing a seatbelt. And I think that one of the things that's even more interesting to me is the difficulty of doing that study, because when we study everybody who had a spinal cord injury, and this is, you know, our greatest number of spinal cord injuries, everybody who had a spinal cord injury, we can only find 14% of them that were wearing a seatbelt. The other 86% are easy to study as the non-seatbelt wearing spinal cord injury. I think it's very telling that we can only find 14% of our folks who were wearing a seatbelt and still sustained a spinal cord injury. I think our hospital sample has been consistent with the national data. Our patients with severe spinal cord injury report non-use of seatbelts more often than not at the time of the accident, and I'm convinced that non-use contributes to the number of Minnesotans living with spinal cord injury and the dramatic change that entails in their lives. These are young men who often weren't thinking about living by their intellect. They were thinking about living by the work of their hands, and those hands are now no longer under their control. In closing, I'd like to urge you to support primary enforcement, and if you have any questions that you think I might be able to answer, I'd be pleased to take those.
Thank you, Mr. Sandman. Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair. Alcine. I'm just curious, when you're talking about $2.5 million a year, are a lot of those people going to be covered via car insurance or in the billing end of this on a long-term injury like that? That same group of people are most likely to be without insurance, too. Do you find that?
In our own setting, and I'm not an expert in this area. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. In our own setting, most of these people, by the time they've gotten to us from the acute care hospital and we're starting to help them rebuild their lives again, they've already applied for medical assistance. And by the time they leave us, most of that $2 million plus money is going to come from public funds.
Thank you, Mr. Sandman.
Thank you.
Our next person is Mr. Tom Comerill from Fergus Falls. Please state your name for the record.
Hello, I'm Tom Cummerell, and I am from Fergus Falls. As Colonel Beers was, I was in law enforcement for 30 years. I retired a few years ago in Fergus Falls. As part of my duties over those 30 years, a big majority of it was patrol work. I worked on the road. One of the things I had to do was make notifications at serious crashes and if you'll talk to any officer, I think he'll tell you that's the hardest part of his job. At one point, I tried to start a program. It's called Stop the Knock. And Stop the Knock was an area where we wanted to stop the notifications that had to be made by law enforcement to families. On October 24th, 2006, that knock came to my door. Shortly before midnight, a good friend of mine, a deputy, came to our door, knocked, and he said, your son is involved in a car crash. It's been over a year, but it's still very hard to talk about. I could see in his face that it wasn't good. I talked to him about it a little bit, and I said, how is he? And he said he's still alive. He said that he was involved in a crash a short distance from our house. It was not a high-speed crash. He was driving a Jeep at the time, which has a full roll cage. The vehicle rolled over once, landed on its wheels, lights still on. Someone heard the crash, came out, didn't find anybody, assumed that the person in the crash had walked away. Then he did call 911, and when rescue people got there, the local fire department, the local ambulance service, the deputy sheriffs, there were some highway patrolmen there. Their first impression, as he tells me, was that whoever was driving it did walk away. This deputy knew whose vehicle it was. And with diligence, they kept checking, and a short time later, they did find my son. And he wasn't that far away from the scene, but he'd been ejected, and he hit a fence post on the side of his head. And he was laying in a woven wire fence, which kind of camouflaged where he was at. It was fortunate it was fairly cool that night. He indicated we should go to the hospital immediately. We did. We got dressed, drove to the hospital in Fergus Falls, went to the emergency room, was allowed in right away. Our son was laying there. I had anticipated seeing a young man who would be quite mangled and bloody, and that's not what I found. I found a young man who was bleeding slightly from the side of his head and his ear and some other small wounds that did not look too bad, but he laid there on a respirator. The doctor said that they'd have to send him to a scan because he did have a head injury. A few minutes later, the doctor approached us and said that he had called for Life Flight helicopter and that we should probably start for Fargo. It's a 45-minute trip to Fargo. It seemed like forever. Got there Medicare, talked to the surgeon. He described what he was going to do. Our son had just arrived. The main concern was his head injury, although he had broken legs, a fractured hip. Described what he's going to do, said it'd be about a two-hour surgery, and he'd get back to us. 4 hours later, he did get back to us. Surgery was over. Explained that the surgery went well. Went in and repaired the bone, took out fragments of bone out of his head, repaired it, put it back in. Described how he had touched the brain, how he had seen the brain. The texture was good. If you've ever been in that position to have somebody talk like that to you, that's very disturbing. But he was very optimistic. He was then to go back into surgery for the ortho surgeon to repair the bones. They said again a two-hour surgery. It turned to 4 hours. Between those surgeries, we were visited by the financial worker at Merit Care. She apologized that she had to come and see us at this time, but she said we'd be waiting there a long time, and it was something she needed to take care of, and we understood. And the things that she collected was, did he have car insurance? And he did. And she took that information. And she did he have health insurance? And he did. His mother made sure of that. And as she talked to us, she said that, you know, the reason they need to get these things started, that before the day was over, his car insurance would probably have maxed out. Up to that point, I hadn't thought about it, and at that particular time, I didn't really put it all together. And she also stated that in the near future, knowing that he'd need some long-term care, that the health insurance would also expire. In our talks, he talked about what his financial abilities. He was a young man. He did not have a lot of physical things. The one thing he did own, an automobile, was no longer with him. And she helped us that day in the future of getting started with financial assistance with the county. He did recover from the, he was in a coma. He recovered from the coma in 6 weeks. That was a long 6 weeks of our lives. I'll back up. After those 8 hours of surgery, he was rushed back to surgery. The third time, the same day, 4 hours again, they removed a piece of his skull 3 by 8 inches off the side of his head, completely removed the bone to allow for swelling of the brain. Very traumatic type thing. It's the type of surgery they do frequently in these trauma type hospitals. And he laid in a coma. At one point, about 5 days into it, we were called in the middle of the night, and he was deteriorating. They told us they couldn't stop it and that he probably would not survive. Being a young guy, fit as he was, that's the only explanation. 2-3 hours after that, he started to get better. And he improved that day and continues today. To make a long story short, he is with us today. He has not been able to return to work. He after 2 months at Merit Care, a little over 2 months, they had another surgery and we replaced the bone back in his head. He was transferred to Fergus Falls where he went into physical therapy. At this point, we were getting medical bills. We would get them on the backside. We would get the notification from the insurance company that they had maxed out and they were returning it to Merit Care. Then we could keep track of where these bills were. But by the time he was in Fergus Falls and doing fairly well, he wasn't able to walk on his own. That's what the physical therapy was about. He had some mind issues also. But those days, where he didn't need a lot of care, had some physical therapies, his bill was about $1,000, $1,100 a day. But the bills that we had seen getting returned before this was in max is in excess of $500,000. When the financial worker told us that his car insurance would max out and soon his health insurance would max out, we did not know, but that did max out that day. We were not in 24 hours, and those two things had maxed out. We also, the hospital helped us and give us direction on how to file disability for him. So we went in and we filed for Social Security disability. And as I said earlier, we filed for MA with the county to help pay his medical bills because we don't have the financial means to pay him. He certainly did not. And that has gotten him through to where he's at today. Where he's at today is he is back home. He lives with us. We feel that someday he's going to be a productive citizen again. But you take a young man who was at one point several years ago, he led a NASCAR racing team. He was the crew chief to where he's at now. And you say this is from what we would call a fairly minor traffic crash. It was a simple rollover. He was ejected from it. The capsule of this Jeep he was driving had no damage within it. Like I said, it had a roll cage. The windshield was cracked. Stayed inside that capsule would have been no reason for any injuries, certainly no serious injuries. We are the lucky ones. My friends, the Choses, weren't that lucky. We are lucky, but financially, I will never, ever pay all those bills. My son will never, ever pay all those bills. They're still accumulating. They're getting to be less. But everybody's going to share in that. And where the dollar amount's going to stop, I have no idea. But that's going to be a burden that's going to be shared by everyone. And that's my reason for talking with you today, just to let you know what the financial impact of one person, one crash who survived. The emotional impact is huge, huge. But the financial impact is as great. It is huge. And I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cumrell. Are there any questions from the committee?
Thank you.
We have another witness, Dr. Alan Beal from North Memorial Medical Center. Dr. Beal is a trauma surgeon. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Alan Beal.
I'm the Associate Director of Trauma and the Director of the Trauma Neuro Intensive Care Unit at North Memorial. Chairman and members, I'm a trauma surgeon, critical care specialist. I'm not stuck away in some office or in a research lab somewhere. Rather, I see and care for trauma patients every day, including many weekend and nighttime hours. I sleep at the hospital at least six nights a month. I'm also the director, as I mentioned, of the ICU at North Memorial, and I spend a great deal of time taking care of some of the most critically ill patients there. The night before last, I operated on a 58-year-old male who was bleeding internally. This past week, I took care of a 40-year-old gentleman who lost both his legs in a car crash. Much of my time is also spent talking to family members and friends of trauma victims, most of whom have survived at North Memorial, but some who do not. On behalf of the more than 10,000 physician, resident, and medical student members of the Minnesota Medical Association, I would like to express strong support for Senate File 16. The MMA has a longstanding policy supporting making failure to wear a seatbelt a primary offense for the simple reason that upgrading our seatbelt law will increase seatbelt use and save lives. I am hopeful that you might remember two points from my brief presentation today. First, that trauma is the biggest killer in this country of people between the ages of 1 and 44, and that motor vehicle crashes are the leading cause of these traumatic deaths. Traffic crashes kill more children each year than all other childhood diseases combined. The second point is that wearing a seatbelt reduces the risk of death and severe injury by more than 50%. This is a fact that I stress to my patients, to their families, and to the surgical residents and medical students who I continue to help train. My children at home are tired of me telling them or reciting this statistic to them over the years. The impact of a body from a crash at 35 miles an hour while not wearing a seatbelt is the equivalent of falling from a third-story window. You can imagine the damage at higher, more common speeds that most of us drive at. Properly worn seatbelts reduce the risk of fatal injury to front seat passengers in a light truck by 60% and in a car by about 45%. As you've heard about rollovers today, rollovers account for about 32% of occupant fatalities, and seatbelts are 74% effective in preventing death in a rollover. I'm a child of the 1960s, and I remember the Vietnam War. Be reminded that each year in this country, the same number of Americans die in auto crashes that were killed in the entire Vietnam conflict. Those deaths changed the course of American history for years to come. As mentioned earlier, this is an epidemic. It's a quiet epidemic. It's an epidemic that does not get a lot of press. I believe that death and destruction on our roads and highways are often taken for granted by many people. A person's or family member's attitude changes quickly, as you've heard today also, when one of their loved ones is suddenly the victim of a car crash. And the worst part of my job also is dealing with family and friends of those who've been injured or have died. It's particularly frustrating when seatbelts were not used, and I know that more than 50% of the injuries and deaths could have been prevented. And I would give anything, just like the law enforcement people who have to knock on doors, to not have to be the bearer of bad news or to continue to see the victims of these traumatic events at the rate that we currently do. These are the reasons that I'm here today to support Senate File 16. I'm confident that a primary seatbelt law will not put our level one trauma centers out of business, but instead it will help reduce the mortality rate from auto crashes and reduce the severity of injuries. We know by other states' examples, such as California, almost 13 years ago, that moving from a secondary to a primary seatbelt law increases the use of seatbelts by as much as 10% and decreases the mortality rates and the injury rates as well. A study by the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety compared driver death rates in 10 states that moved from a secondary to a primary seatbelt law and compared them against states like Minnesota, and there were 14 of them that they compared them against. who stuck with the secondary law. Death rates fell by 7% in the primary seatbelt states. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration estimates, as again you've heard, that upgrading Minnesota's law to a primary offense could save probably somewhere 40 lives or greater and prevent more than 400 serious injuries each year. Can you imagine the impact that this type of trauma prevention could have not only on individuals and their families, but also on already stressed medical and insurance industries? The CODE study that was released last year and estimated that there could be a cumulative health care cost savings of approximately $187 million over 10 years for hospital, inpatient, and emergency use alone if seatbelt usage was increased to 94%, which is the goal that, well, we're all shooting for 100%, but a reasonable goal in Minnesota is around 94%. Currently, as you've heard, somewhere around 83% of Minnesotans comply with the mandatory seatbelt law. In the state of Washington, the seatbelt use jumped from about 11% to 92% after they went to their primary seatbelt law. This is definitely a health care issue that we can do something about at minimal cost. So I hope that the members of this committee will support Senate File 16. A vote for a primary seatbelt law, in my opinion, is a vote to preserve life and limb. I'm trying to do that each and every day, one patient at a time. I truly believe that if you were to spend a day in my shoes and had the view that I do of car crash victims and their families, that you would vote for the passage of the bill, knowing that the use of seatbelts improves morbidity and mortality. Seatbelt primary offense laws have been shown to increase seatbelt use and reduce injury and death from motor vehicle crashes. Mr. Chairman and members, thanks for the opportunity to testify. Are there any questions?
Thank you, Dr. Beal. Any questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Dr. Beal. Do you support allowing insurance companies to charge different rates based on whether people wear their seatbelt or not?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson.
Dr. Beal.
I really haven't given that a lot of thought, in all honesty. It makes some sense to me. I think it would be awfully hard in some ways to maybe document that, but I certainly would. It's very frustrating when you look at the, and so many people are young and healthy, when you look at the injuries that they have and realize that 50% of those may not have been, have even occurred without wearing seatbelts. So my simple answer is I probably would.
So, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, in the, I believe in law that's being amended, it specifically says on page 1, line 21 and 22, that the Department of Public Safety shall not record a violation of the subdivision on a person's driving record. So we've specifically not allowed this to become a matter of record so that insurance companies or anybody else could know that. Now, I don't. Why do we have a policy like that?
Oh. Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, I would be, if you want to strike the language after the period on page 1, line 21, and then all of line 22, I would have no problem. But in return, I would also ask you to do me another favor so that we can accurately document what's going on in our roads, and that's the repeal of Daimler. If you would help me to repeal Daimler, I will help you repeal this law.
Senator Olson.
And members, Daimler is simply the law that says that if you're in a 55-mile-an-hour speed zone and you get a ticket that's something less than 65, it doesn't go on your record. That's the only speed limit that Daimler is good for. So if you're at 35 and you get a ticket at 40, it goes on your record. But if you're at 55 and you get a ticket for 64, it doesn't go on your record. Now, this is more of that speeding kills. Speed kills, we all know that. If the speed limit is 70 and you're going 72 and you get a ticket, it goes on your license. So Daimler is, I think, the... You know, back when we changed the speed limit to 55 during the energy crisis, in the, well, not the last one or the one before that, but the one in the early 70s. The theory was we were going to save gasoline. And so if we were going to do this, one of the brilliant representatives in the chamber at the time named Senator Dimler, and I think he might have been a friend of somebody on the committee, said that, you know, if we're going to do that, let's not make it so expensive for the drivers, and let's not put it on their driving record. Otherwise, insurance companies will find out. I think the time for Dimler has come and gone, much as some of this other reporting of violations, especially when it comes to behaviors, Senator Olson. If you don't wear your seatbelt, boy, I think that should be reported.
So Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Senator Murphy, why don't we do this? Why don't we correct that? What's the problem?
Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I have no problem. If you want to make the motion to strike that language or you want to introduce a bill, we'll hear it next committee hearing.
Well, Mr. Chairman, why don't you do it? This is your bill. And you have a safety, a fire and brimstone, you know, speech on safety.
Right.
I'm asking kind of a rhetorical question, is why do we do that? Would that actually be more effective because it hits everybody in their pocketbook and without ever having to have using law enforcement to get one here and there?
Senator Murphy.
Well, Madam Chairman, I'm Senator Olson. I will have a, since you would support the bill if I did that. Come on, that was supposed to be funny, guys. I'm losing my touch here. Senator Olson, I will have an amendment. I'll take your advice. I like that idea. Personally, I'd never thought of it before. But now that you've sparked some interest amongst the committee members, I'll have an amendment ready for Senator Moy's committee, and maybe we'll just take care of all that at once, and maybe we'll take care of Dimler and some of these other things that are prohibiting law enforcement from doing their full job. But Senator Olson, law enforcement still has to pull the person over not wearing a seatbelt for it to be reported to the insurance company. So law enforcement still has to be involved. Is it low-hanging fruit? Yeah, it is. Speeders are low-hanging fruit. And I would encourage members of the committee to talk with Chief Dinansky and go out and ride around with some state troopers from time to time. You'll find out that they can write 6 speeding tickets in 30 minutes. I've witnessed that. Because people are driving. This isn't Daytona. And we have to slow people down. And, you know, even if you're driving 55 miles an hour, the speed limit, and you get in an accident and you're not wearing your seatbelt, I think the doctor just testified that your chances of having some serious bodily injury is exponentially higher than if you would have wore your lap belt. And, Senator Olson, regardless of what happens here today, law enforcement is still the component. There's still the people out on the road that are going to enforce this law, whether it's some sort of violation as stated in the bill or whether it's some sort of reporting mechanism to the insurance companies.
Senator Chairman, Senator Murphy, this is current law, and I think there's a lot of people that have been pulled over for a lot of things that have been affected by the secondary, but it's never been allowed to be reported. But I'm still, why do we have a problem that we're protecting in that area rather than using just this this one vehicle? The way you're responding to me and saying is, do you not think that those would pass? And if not, why not?
Well, Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, you've been around when I've tried to repeal Dimler, and you've seen how well that's went. I think that this would go down the same road. And I'm not going to weight the bill down by putting a whole bunch of stuff on it unless I have your full support to vote yes on the bill, and you're going to drag along some of your colleagues to vote yes on the bill. If you would give me that commitment, I'll rip that out of there. I'll introduce another bill to get rid of Dimler and all these other things, and then we'll have true honesty out on our roads, or at least in the reporting mechanisms.
Senator Olson.
But Mr. Chairman, you're still avoiding what is it about us that does not, I'm trying to get at, if we're trying to convince somebody, why would we not support something that probably would go even further in terms of the behavior change than this particular piece of it?
Mr. Chairman, but Senator Olson, on that point, you're wrong, because most kids don't pay their own car insurance.
Okay.
And so they could give a rip whether Ms. Bierzowski's, her son gets pulled over, and then all of a sudden she has to end up paying it. You know, most kids are going to go, big deal. You know, Ma paid it or Dad paid it. You know, it's not a big deal. And they're going to go off driving, and the seatbelt's still going to be hanging in the rack. That doesn't change the behavior of young people. What's going to change the behavior of young people is if they get that fine right in their hand right now. Those increase of insurance costs don't happen for months later. I mean, you know the way it is. You either buy your insurance month to month, or you buy a six-month block or a year block, and by the time the policy comes due, it might be August of 08, and, you know, you've completely forgot it, and you look at your insurance statement, and instead of paying $634 every 6 months, now you're going to pay $655. And you're just going to look at it and go, oh, that must have just been the increase of the cost of business, and just write out the check and send it in without even thinking. Do you read every line on your insurance? Well, no, wait a minute. I know you do, so I'm not going to answer that. But, I mean, think about it. Does everybody in here read every line on their insurance before they write the check and send it in? No, you don't. When you go to buy insurance, you go down to your agent. And if, you know, your agent's probably a friend of yours, just like everybody's agents are, you go in there and you talk to them a little bit, and you say, this is what I'm driving, this is how many miles, and they go, well, you know, what's your car worth, and blah, blah, blah. Okay, you write them a check, and you're done. And, you know, things like that never come up. Senator Olson, answer your question directly. I had nothing to do with the institution of the Department of Public Safety shall not record a violation of this subdivision on a person's driving record. I don't even think I was in the legislature when that was put in the books, but I'm glad that you're thinking about helping us repeal that.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Murphy, I will make a confession. I don't know my insurance agent, but former Representative Dimler does farm my land.
Senator Murphy, has Campion arrived? Next person is Michael Campion, Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. Please state your name
Mr.
for the
Chairman,
record.
Committee members, thank you. Michael Campion is my name. I'm the Commissioner of Public Safety. Department of Public Safety works with and represents the interests of a wide variety of first responders and emergency responders, public safety responders throughout the entire state of Minnesota, above and beyond just law enforcement. And I am here in support of the bill. Since I became Commissioner of Public Safety, which will be 3 years this April, frankly, I've become very passionate about the passage of this bill. I have three items that I'll share with you, and I'll be very brief. First, the governor last year and this year has stated that as a legislator, he supported this legislation. He was a co-author, as I understand it. If it gets to his desk, he'll sign it. Second, this legislation has some very unique aspects to it. You can argue the numbers. You cannot argue the outcome. If it's only 25 to 30 people whose lives are saved in the course of a year, if it's only 200 people who are not dismembered, disfigured, or disabled as a result of this legislation, it's a very significant piece of legislation, no question about it. If there was a piece of legislation in front of you that cost $1 million or $2 million or $3 million, and the challenge was to legislators, do I put money here or do I put money here, that would be an obstacle for you to overcome. This legislation, committee members, has a fiscal note to it, and that's a $15 million one-time appropriation to the state of Minnesota for traffic safety to improve our safety on the Minnesota's highways. 71% of the people in the state of Minnesota, the last count that I have seen, support primary seatbelt as a law from this legislative body. And 83% of the driving public already adheres to this piece of legislation. So you're not looking at a piece of legislation that half the people in Minnesota would be for and half the people of Minnesota would not be for. Lastly, I believe it was Newt Gingrich that said, be for something that's going to happen anyway. Primary seatbelt is going to happen one of these days anyway. And it's very analogous to .08. .08 legislation was passed a couple years ago, and it's unfortunate to say that Minnesota was, I think, the last state that passed .08. Now, frankly, committee members, I don't know that as a state that's something that we should be enormously proud of. Now, contributions from the legislature to contribute to the result of the lowest traffic fatality rate in the state of Minnesota in the course of a year is, in fact, something to be proud of. I hope that you do support this piece of legislation.
Thank you, Commissioner Campion. Any questions? Senator Olson. Yeah,
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Campion, you said that this bill carries a $15 million appropriation or price tag?
Senator Olson, I was being a little bit coy. The fiscal note is a one-time $15 million appropriation from the federal government to the state of Minnesota to be used for traffic safety related activities. It doesn't cost the legislature any money to pass this piece of legislation. My point being, the outcomes are as has been testified to already, at no cost at all. In fact, in an incentive of $15 million.
So, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Campion, how would you see the $15 million being used?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I think that it was a PowerPoint presentation that talked about the related areas. Most of it, I think, would go to the Department of Transportation for traffic safety improvements, cabling along certain highways that have been proven to reduce fatalities and serious accidents. So it would virtually all go to traffic safety-related activities, most of it to Department of Transportation.
Any other questions from the committee? Senator Mua.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, we've heard some very compelling testimonies and personal stories from families today. I'm a co-author of this bill, and in the 4 years I've been here, it's surfaced time and again, and for my children, I would like to see it pass. And the support for this this bill is just overwhelming. But there's one letter that came to us from the ACLU that talks about a potential unintended consequences as a result of this initiative passing. And I'm wondering if in this $15 million that's going to be coming from the federal government, if there is a way we could in some way attempt to address or to take a look at some of the concerns that were raised in this statement from the ACLU with respect to the potential unintended consequences.
Mr. Chair, Senator Mao, I would, if that is within the guidelines of the federal government's, in terms of areas we can spend it on, would certainly entertain the thought of doing that. Be happy to.
Senator Mao.
And Mr. Chair, Commissioner, I see here that one of the guidelines is for cable median barriers, one is for speed enforcement, and then the other is for aid to county and state roads for engineering improvements. Perhaps not the first or the third, but I think that within the speed enforcement, there might be some room, and I would encourage you and other law enforcement officers to look at that, because as much as I care about this, I'm also concerned about the potential unintended consequences here. Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, I have a couple remarks and then I'll make a motion. First, committee members, when I asked Ms. Spirozowski to put the bill together, I had forgot to tell her that we needed to have an enactment date. Without an enactment date, this would, if it would pass and the governor would sign it into law, would become effective August 1st, I believe. Because there is some financial implications here of getting this money from the federal government, Ms. Spirozowski and myself and Ms. Boyd will work on getting the appropriate effective date put on this, and we'll put that on in Senator Moy's committee if that's okay with the committee. It's just we just need to figure out what date has to be in there so we can plug in this federal money. That's just for your information. We'll also take care of cleaning up that language around the fines and surcharges in Senator Moy's committee. They're the experts on it. We can sit around here and, we're more experts in pouring concrete and building light rail and commuter rail than we are in dealing with, the nuances of fines, penalties, and that's Senator Moy's gig. Members, first I want to apologize to Senator Olson. Senator Olson, I had earlier said that something about cowardly. I didn't mean that. Members, I've been serving with Senator Olson for 15 years now, and the first couple of years we were on the higher ed committee together, and Senator Olson, I witnessed some pretty brazen act of courage from you on a couple instances when you were bucking the system, and so I didn't mean that the way that it came out, and I apologize. Members, we've heard a lot of testimony, but Senator Olson, sometimes when I get worked up and I start saying things like this, it's because I've been doing the seatbelt thing now for a few years, and even back when I was a new member on the committee and Senator Langseth or someone else was carrying the bill, and even when Senator Foley carried the bill, we've been hearing this gut-wrenching testimony, and we tried to keep it to a dull roar today, but much like Catherine Swanson, we're kind of frustrated trying to get this bill through the legislature, and a lot of us have heard these stories time and time again, and it doesn't get any easier on us. We want a primary seatbelt law, and to answer a portion of your question the other day, or just a few minutes ago, whatever changes that need to be made in this bill to garner more support in the legislature, we're willing to do it, Senator Olson. So if you have any ideas that are going to enhance our bill, we're more than willing to take them on. Members, this means a lot, and there's not a member around the table or a person in this room whose lives have not been affected by a highway fatality. Look at your extended family. Look at the people that live across the street. Look at your friends at work. Everybody has had some sort of fatal accident within their eyesight. And if it was your family, if it was your daughter or your son or your cousin or your aunt or uncle, you'd feel the same way that many of these people who are supporting this bill do today. Members, I don't think that we've ever passed a bill in the 14 years that I've been here that have had this many supporters. These are thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans. We heard the commissioner say that currently 80-plus percent of the people wear their seatbelt. That's 80-some percent of the people in this state say that primary seatbelt, that's what they believe that we have right now. And you know what? The people that know that we only have a secondary law, they're normally younger kids that have just went through driver's training because they learned that. And so here we are. We're trying to 25% of those people that die that are unbelted, 16 to 25. That's the demographic that we're trying to reach with this bill because they're the ones that know that they can't get pulled over. They could be drinking a beer and having a good time, and as long as this law officer didn't see that beer come up into the windshield or he wasn't driving all like that, he wouldn't be able to pull them over. But I tell you what, if this law enforcement officer saw somebody driving down the road and their seatbelt's hanging in the rack and it's one of these 17-year-old kids, and he pulls them over and writes them a ticket, and then they decide to wear their seatbelt from then on, we've won. We have won the day because everybody in here is going to get in an accident. The severity depends on a lot of different circumstances, mainly of which is the ability of the driver to control the car. But what we don't have control over is when we go into the ditch and that car rolls over. We don't have control anymore. We've lost control. We want people to wear their seatbelts. It's pure and simple. We've got hundreds of thousands of people that support it. I put this in our packet. This was a sheet that we'd used last year that shows every county of how many fatalities there were in each and every county. And then it also goes on to the further right, and it talks about the occupants that were unbelted. In the county that I live in, Goodhue County, there were 36 people that were killed between 2000 and 2004. 22 weren't wearing a seatbelt. I would have to say that instead of 22, if those 36 had been wearing a seatbelt, that number would probably be 10 or 11. Those are people I know. And, you know, when I was first in the legislature, Senator Langseth pulled me aside and said, kid, you got a couple things to learn. One of them is sometimes you have to take tough votes. Now, members, I'll be up front with you. The people that are going to scream the loudest about you voting yes on this are the people that, one, either don't want to wear a seatbelt or don't believe that we have the ability to control what you do inside the car. Here's chapter 169. I stuck a pen in it. There's almost 300 pages of statutes that dictate our behavior on the roads. Almost 300 pages. And as I said earlier, this is the most regulated thing that we do on a daily basis. I do believe that we have the right to tell people that you have to wear a seatbelt. Members, with that, I would move that that Senate File 16, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary.
All those in favor?
Aye.
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 All those opposed? Senate File 16, as the motion to pass has passed, and we will stand adjourned for the day.
Thank you.
I was
I mean, then, you know, maybe.